I think it's time to move on to Lucien. So, speaking on Sloterdijk, who was actually the original inspiration for our thinking about a lot of these issues. So we can return to that field of raising questions.
Great, thanks. So I've been tasked with speaking about Sloterdijk. There's no Sloterdijk scholars in there.
No.
Okay, great. Okay, then I can proceed. Yeah. So it was as Jessica said that like it was about 2 years ago or so we were reading Sloterdijk's "You Must Change Your Life" in our phenomenology readings, and it was from that. This whole emphasis on verticality that somehow or other gave birth to what we have today, this project. So Sloterdijk is, as far as I can tell, he's got a penchant for spatial metaphorics. Mm-hmm. He likes he wrote his sort of magnum opus is called Spheres. It's a sort of this huge tomb. It's a trilogy. Which he sees as he's reported to have said it was a counterpart, or he saw it as a counterpart to Heidegger's Being in Time. It's the book that Heidegger would have written, or Division 3 or something, or like the book after Being in Time. Being in Space, that is. So it's, in a sense, it's a meditation, or he's meditating on the being in, but in contrast to what Heidegger said, is not to be seen as locational. Actually, he's mining it for mining location, I guess you could say, or space. So, then in the book that I'm going to talk about today, his "You Must Change Your Life," whereas Spheres seems to sort of mine space for notions of intimacy, "You Must Change Your Life" employs the lens of verticality or the vertical line, which he counterposes to horizontality. So he says, whereas the horizontal is dominated by a relative symmetry of outward and return journeys, vertical mobility is often characterized by an asymmetry, when the descent is not simply a mirror of the ascent, no application of the Heraclitean formula, the way up and the way down are the same, but rather a fall. We heard from Donovan Schaefer yesterday. He was talking about evolutionary biology in relation to religion. and he said there that notions of higher and lower are ultimately anthropocentric illusions, mm-hmm. right? Whereas Sloterdijk wants to retrieve notions of hierarchy. He sees them as actually essential to being. But importantly, this is a hierarchy he wants to extricate from structures of power, oppression and mastery over others, and locate it in a mastery over oneself. So, which is to move from what he sees as a theory of, class-based society or a model of class society of society based on class, where vertical differentiation takes place through dominance and repression and privilege, etc., to a theory of society based on discipline, which entails vertical differentiation through asceticism, virtuosity, and achievement. So I have found this particularly helpful for my own work, in the sense that I've discovered conceptions of transformation within religion. Which often, when interpreted by cultural and social historians, they don't seem to be able to do justice in any sense to the vertical impulse which seems to be sort of a framing religious practice in a sense, or giving it some impetus. So he says. Sorry, this is going to be a whole series of quotes. I don't. As anyone would concede, nothing is more obviously natural than for humans to be entangled in habits. Nothing could be less obviously natural, however, than for individuals who not infrequently later act as pioneers in questions of world orientation for their collectives to find themselves in a secession from habits. Precisely this is the movement towards the superordinary that can be observed in the ancient birthplaces of philosophy in Greece as well as in India and China. cultural historians associate this process with such phenomena as urbanization and division, and the division of labor, which would be a kind of pseudo-verticality, in a sense, which does little to elucidate the matter. What is genuinely thought-provoking, however, is the question of how, in the course of this secession, the complex of acquired habits as such could become thematic, and the thought of superordinary things powerful within individual humans. So it's to ask the question of what is inspiring this move, sort of out of a conditioning, in a sense, out of habit, and to reach for something beyond ourselves, which seems to be at least one of the guiding impulses for religious practice, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, so that idea has provided, a helpful lens through which to explore religious transformation, practice, etc. So he takes the title of his book, You Must Change Your Life, from Rilke's poem, The Archaic Torso of Apollo, in which there's, is anyone familiar with that? I don't have it to hand right now, but basically it's the, you can draw it, exactly, it's the headless torso of Apollo, which is somehow, despite the fact that it doesn't have a head or eyes or legs, or is still speaking to you. It's a command from the stone, he calls it, imploring you to change your life. There is no place that does not see you. It says, change your life, right? Mm-hmm. So he calls this the metanoetic imperative, which is derived from the Greek metanoein, which is a change of one's mind, which I found the notion of metanoesis is actually a neologism coined, interestingly, by a Japanese or a member of the Kyoto School of Japanese Buddhism called Tanabe Hajime, who wrote a book about a philosophy as metanoesis. Which I don't know whether Sloterdijk actually has read that book, but that seems to be the first place that the term comes up, where he talks about reason sort of encountering paradoxes that it can't resolve by itself, in confrontation with which it is forced to redirect itself inward, and in a sense become repentant or remorseful at its own inability, which then brings about this radical change. It pulls you above those paradoxes, in a sense. It forces you to move higher. And in a sense, the metanoetic imperative in Sloterdijk is doing just that as well. So he says of this imperative, you must change your life. This is the imperative that exceeds the options of hypothetical and categorical. It is the absolute imperative, the quintessential metanoetic command. It provides the key word for revolution in the second person singular. It defines life as a slope from its higher to its higher to lower forms, or lower to higher forms, right? I'm already living, but something is telling me with unchallengeable authority, you are not living properly. If you do indeed subsequently change your life, what you are doing is no different from what you desire with your whole will, as soon as you feel how a vertical tension that is valid for you unhinges your life. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that is then to root such an imperative in human life is to thus construe human beings as essentially self-shaping and practicing beings. That is to submit oneself to this imperative presupposes the practice of submitting to a transformation, a kind of ascesis of self-overcoming. Mm-hmm. Right? The whole of this book, You Must Change, is in a sense a kind of grand history of how this command manifests itself throughout civilizations, and in the pre-modern period, such vertical tensions which give shape to the imperative are encoded in metaphysical forms or which are preeminently religious. Mm-hmm. So in this in the pre-modern context. Vertical tensions take shape as these key distinctions, these polarities between things like transcendence and immanence, or the sacred and the profane, or completeness and incompleteness, where the first pole is the attractor pulling you upward, and the latter pole is that by which you're being repelled, that you want to rise above, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So quintessentially, God, or the divine, ultimately, is the most convincing attractor, right? For those forms of life and practice which strove towards him. And as he says, this towards him was identical with upwards. Now, come the Enlightenment and all the scientific developments during that period, there was what he sees as a leveling of reality, which signals a great unscrewing of vertical tensions which were coded in religiosity and other forms of myths and ethics, etc. An unscrewing of those from their encasings. Yet, importantly, in spite of that, there is nevertheless what he sees as the persistence of verticality in the aftermath of the death of God, or the severing of transcendence. And as he identifies Nietzsche as the principal witness of a kind of post-metaphysical or post-God verticality. Right, so he says he was witness to the vertical dimension without God. Right, this is which he sees as symbolized. He takes Thus Spake Zarathustra as a kind of key moment in this, and symbolized it. There's an episode like towards the beginning of the book where there's this where Zarathustra is walking through the marketplace and declaring the carving of the overhuman and deploring the last man, etc. And at the time, there's a tightrope walker. There's a rope stretched between two towers of the marketplace, and this it's almost there's an identification of the tightrope walker in some sense is kind of the overhuman, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah, meant to symbolize that. And then there's the scene in that where then as he's prophesying the coming of the overhuman, the tightrope walker starts walking across the rope, and at some point he's doing these incredible things, but at some point someone comes up and some buffoon apparently walks up from behind and jumps over him and he loses his balance and he falls down to the ground, at which point just as he's about to die he regains consciousness but he's dying nonetheless, and he goes to Zarathustra, what are you doing here? He said, I have long known that the devil would trip me up. Now he is dragging me off to hell. Do you want to prevent him? And on my honor, friend, answered Zarathustra, all you are speaking of does not exist. There is no devil and no hell. Your soul will be dead even sooner than your body, so fear nothing more. The man looked up mistrustfully. If you are speaking the truth, he said, then I lose nothing when I lose my life. I am not much more than a beast that has been taught to dance by being dealt blows and meager morsels. Not so, said Zarathustra. You have made danger your calling. There is nothing in that to despise. Now your calling has brought you down. Therefore will I bury you with my own hands. Mm-hmm. So he says this is a key moment in the identification of post-metaphysical vertical tensions. Mm. He sees the rope actually as the symbol of whereas in the pre-modern period the rope might have symbolized from one end being tied to earth and the other to the divine. Mm. After that, it still continues to be held in tension between two poles. So, which of course raises the question, what's holding it in tension now, mm-hmm. after God, once that's gone? Mm-hmm. And he wants to locate that actually in, I'll get to that. he says, what this scene really reveals is an unveiling of what were seen as, what was coded in the form of religion or asceticism in the pre-modern period, now becomes a subset of acrobatics, actually. So there's a transition from pre-modern asceticism to modern and postmodern acrobatics, I guess you could say, which is, Sloterdijk writes, whoever looks for humans will find ascetics, and whoever observes ascetics will discover acrobats. Thus, which is now therefore to sit side by side, charioteers and scholars, wrestlers and church fathers, archers and rhapsodists come together, united by shared experiences on the way to the impossible. The world ethos is formulated by a council of acrobats, which is what it was all along. So in a sense, this is a kind of demythologization of religion. There's what's really been driving religion all along has been vertical tensions, which he wants to root not so much, well, it can't be rooted anymore in something beyond the human realm, but actually within humans themselves. So then the question, what is it that keeps the rope in tension now, after the death of God, after the leveling off of reality, after the severing of transcendence from the world? What becomes of metaphysical desire, which still seems to express itself? It expresses itself as doing feats that are incredible, impossible, moving beyond oneself, doing acrobatics. That's what, it says it's the supposed tensile strain from above proves, in fact, to be an aversive tension from within. That is, now the tension actually he wants to locate within man himself. So he quotes Nietzsche, and I guess you could see the whole book, You Must Change Your Life, as a kind of meditation on this, that the human, Nietzsche says, is a rope fastened between beast and overman, and overhuman. Right, so and then this is a rope over an abyss, which is the scary part. But this then is to see life itself as providing what he calls the inner gradient between higher and lower, more and less. Right, and it contains the vertical component that guides ascents within itself and has no need for additional external or metaphysical attractors. Now, sorry, have I got to finish now?
Yeah, five minutes.
Yeah, I just 5 minutes left. That's no problem. Right. So, to sort of better understand how this works, then how is it that life provides this inner gradient? I think it's helpful to, towards the beginning of the book, in his introduction, in fact, he introduces the concept of the immune system, which plays a kind of background but very important role throughout the book. So immune systems are, he says, embodied expectations of injury and the corresponding programs of protection and repair, which enable systems to become systems, life forms and cultures to become cultures, by reproducing themselves with constant reference to a potentially invasive and irritating environment. So, in relation to humans, he sees three spheres of immunology. The first is the basic biological sphere, then there comes the social, and then finally the symbolic or psychic, at which level... So they're kind of recapitulations, they're from lower to higher, forming more developed systems, or immune systems. Religion, or this realm of what he wants to call, in fact, anthropotechnics, which is what these exercises through which humans work on themselves to further themselves, to transcend themselves, that takes place. So he says, at the biological level, such immune systems are already organismic early forms of feeling for transcendence, right? And constitute a preliminary stage to the behavior one is accustomed to terming religious or spiritual in human contexts. So he says that in his analysis of this third sphere, this highest or most developed symbolic or psychic sphere, he speaks of the methods of mental and physical practicing by which humans from the most diverse cultures have attempted to optimize their cosmic immunological status in the face of vague risks of living and acute certainties of death. Which is basically to say that anthropotechnics, the exercises by which humans work on themselves to transcend themselves, are, in a sense, forms of immunology, which is then to frame the kind of meta tension, if you will, as ultimately I would say health, at a symbolic level, whatever that means, which is this is in a sense to draw on Heidegger's notion of the human or Dasein man as a self-concerned or caring being. It's a concern for itself. It's an immunological being, which he calls Homo. So he says of the account of man in the book, the hero of the following account is Homo immunologicus, who must give his life with all its dangers and surface a symbolic framework. It's the human being that struggles with itself in concern for its form. He says, we will characterize it more closely as the ethical human being, or rather, Homo repetitivus, Homo artista, or the human in training. Really, so his analysis of man as a being in training, as a man that works on himself, is in a sense ancillary to an analysis of man as a self-caring being, as an immunological being that's defending itself against the threats of its environment, which ultimately, which is its transcendence. So that's to say then that this meta-tension is health, expressed alternatively as integration or protection or preservation, and the vertical movement it incites might thus be defined as a therapeutic or restorative one, right? So really we're talking about, again, yeah, it's what's going on here is therapy. it's health, whatever health means in this context, because of course we're dealing at it's not the bodily sense of health, but a symbolic one. So it says life itself appears as a dynamics of integration that is equipped with autotherapeutic or endoclinical competencies, which I guess is to say then that the question that arises from all this is that, so how do you distinguish between different kinds of exercises? What are those that are good that we should embrace, and those that are in some sense promoting health, whatever it means, and then he gives some indication of what it might mean to promote health, what the symptom of a healthy being is. A being ultimately that seems to be, in some sense, what does he say? Those activity, it's like joy or excitement as a symptom of health. So he says we can no longer go anywhere from this world. After Heidegger, there's nowhere to go. There is no, you know, etc. After Nietzsche, even, but the least that we can do is to lift ourselves out of dullness, dejection, and obsession, and above all, out of banality. That's what I've got from reading it. I don't know how true that is. That's an attempt.
Cool, thank you very much. Yeah.